Kids. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here's one line to sum up this hour. Carrying out elections is complicated stuff. A Cliff's Notes version of how voting works in America is practical, and a recent headline by a Washington Post columnist says it best. Finally, there is a handbook on voting. We're spending the hour on civic literacy and the right to vote. No judgment here because, you know, civics class was many moons ago. What confuses you about our country's voting processes? What is the greatest threat you see to free and fair elections? We're at 800-642-1234 throughout the hour. Kimberly Whaley is a law professor at the University of Baltimore. Her areas of expertise are administrative law, civil procedure, and the federal courts. And her new book is called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Kim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Well,
looking forward.
How do you, I mean, you kind of take this cookbook approach to the book. Why are our voting systems kind of like recipes?
Because they vary across the country, not only by state, but by certain precincts within a state or counties within a state. And that's because the framers of the Constitution decided to leave it to individual states to decide how to actually implement election systems. And so really, how your right to vote translates for where you live depends on your zip code. So I thought of, you know, when I thought about the book, I came up with a two-step recipe because it really is important not just to get registered, but to also make sure you show up at with the proper identification on registration day. There are some steps in America that in most places we need to be sure that we take and plan ahead in order to be able to exercise this precious right to vote. Some states it's easier than others, but because it varies by zip code, the book walks through all of it.
Yeah, so registering in Florida, very different than registering perhaps in Maine or another state. You know, broadly speaking, what are those two steps, recipe steps, to know that when it comes to election day, you're ready to go?
Well, number one is to make sure that you're registered to vote under federal law. If you go to the Department of Motor Vehicles at any time, the DMV has to give you an opportunity to register to vote. So that's an easy way to do it. If you don't have a driver's license, or as we've seen with COVID, registrations have gone down in part because those are closed. There's not that access to voting is not available. So step two, there's also a federal law that allows you to register by mail on a common application. So that information is online, but you have to log in to find it. Every state's Secretary of State website should have the most up-to-date information. It's also on other websites that consolidate this. But, you know, the idea behind the book was to have a commercially available handbook that can be on your shelf. You'll have to make sure that the information is completely up-to-date for a new election under the Secretary of State. But one place where you can kind of understand all of it. Step two then would be to make sure you know when the polls are open, to figure out what kind of identification, if any, you need in order to register your vote on that day to actually vote. Some states have stricter ID requirements than others. So you want to make sure that not only you've registered, but that when you show up on election day, you have whatever documentation your state requires in order for you to exercise your right to vote. So that's the two-step recipe, getting all that in order. And I should say, registering alone is not sufficient over several election cycles, because there's something called, people call it voter purging, but there is a system in place to make sure the polls are accurate. So you really should, 8 weeks before an election, get online and just make sure you still are registered. And the last piece is, in times of COVID, we're seeing more and more states expand access to mail-in voting due to COVID. A lot of states, you have to have an excuse. You have to be elderly or live or outside the country on the date of the election. You have to have a reason to be able to vote by mail. That tent is getting expanded. So if you might be in a state where maybe the last election cycle you were not eligible to vote by mail, but now you are eligible to vote by mail, and therefore it's important to ask for your mail-in ballot in advance of actually voting.
Yeah,
in most states you have to ask for it.
You hit on two big issues front and center in Wisconsin right now, the voter purge, a big issue, as well as absentee voting. Talking with Kim Whaley, legal analyst for CBS News, author of the new book, What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. And you can join in. Have you ever experienced issues at the polls due to your identification or your registration? What advice do you have about how to handle those situations in future elections? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Kim, people move around. Some move more frequently across state lines than others. What is your advice for staying on top of your voter registration, and especially now in COVID, where we might see a spike in evictions or people might have to move more quickly as they lose their job?
Right. So the way voter registration works is the last place that you registered is the place where you are considered a registered voter. So, for example, if I were to move, I live in Maryland, if I were to move to New York over the weekend, I would still be registered in Maryland until I re-register in the new state of my residence, New York. So if you recently moved out of state, you might decide to change your voter registration to your new state, but you should be registered in your prior state. That's a bit different from moving within your state, because moving within your state is going to make the determine where you actually vote on election day. And of course, we're seeing that change also because of COVID. A lot of the polls or locations are being closed. So I think regardless of whether you moved or not, also logging on your Secretary of State's website, putting in your address to find out under this pandemic where you physically need to show up, because it might be different from the last election when we weren't under a particular pandemic. Unfortunately, this is one of those situations where you have to plan ahead. You have to kind of be vigilant about making sure that you're registered and that you know exactly where to go. And so what I recommend is people just put it in their calendar, maybe do something now, make sure you're registered now. And because of COVID, ask for that mail-in ballot now. And we saw this with the midterms in Wisconsin, where a lot of ballots, mail-in ballots came in later. Registrations to vote by mail or request to vote by mail came in later. And these are really big, complex exercises to pull off, these elections in particular or in general. And so it's really important that the election officials know who's coming to the party. They can anticipate the numbers. So the earlier that you get your paperwork in order, the better. And then I would say, you know, make sure, just again, log on. There's a number of websites in my book, but again, Secretary of State's websites, you can follow up and make sure that you're registered. If you don't get your mail-in ballot in time, unfortunately, take your hand sanitizer, take your mask, and plan to show up on election day.
How do voter ID laws affect college students? Because there are federal lawsuits pending that are challenging that the requirement to show a photo ID at polling places. What about college students?
Yeah, so college students, again, if they decide to stay registered in the state in which they grew up, they should be fine. So if they've registered when they were in high school, they've voted before, where say they grew up, if they lived with their parents, where it gets tricky is where they've decided to vote in their state where their college is located. So if I have a child in Maryland who goes to University of Wisconsin and decides, listen, I would like to vote in Wisconsin
for
whatever reason, then that child will have to satisfy the requirements in Wisconsin, both, again, the two-step. Step number one, register. Step number two, vote. So each state will have its own registration requirements. For example, a residency requirement. Certain college students might not qualify if they don't satisfy the residency requirement. And then when they go to the polls in Wisconsin, if they do get themselves registered, Wisconsin might have tighter ID laws, step two of the recipe, when they actually go to vote. So that does require education and tenacity and, you know, getting the ducks in the row in advance.
Law Professor Kim Whaley, our guide, back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're getting a primer on voting rights in America. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The new book is called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. And with a polarized Congress, author Kim Whaley says voting is a check on the existence of democracy itself. So we're doing this electoral CAT scan, if you will, to better understand how voting processes work and what internal threats exist to our system of democracy. What do you want to know about voter suppression, about misinformation? How do you think Wisconsin is doing in terms of access to the ballot box? Are you worried about voter fraud? Do you think it exists? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Author and law professor Kim Whaley is our guide. So Dan called in from Two Rivers, couldn't stay with us, Kim. He says back in college, Dan was part of a group that would get people out to vote. And after talking with him, Dan says many didn't know what the issues were at hand. They said they were either Republican or Democrat, and they always voted that way. Dan says that is very concerning. What are your thoughts on how we get people out to vote?
So let me just put a pin in the website question. I want your listeners to know USA.gov, which is an official government website, that will take you to your state's information on voting, USA.gov. So the number one studies show the number one obstacle to voting, and only about half or 50% of all eligible voters in the United States actually exercise their right to vote. The number one barrier, studies show, is apathy or cynicism, the belief that my vote doesn't count, the belief that I'm in such a solidly blue state or such a solidly red state, it doesn't matter if I vote, or I just don't like the candidates and I want to have a better choice. Some of that has to do with our two-party system. Some of this has to do with how each state decides to count their votes. There are Maine, for example, I believe, is going to what's known as ranked choice voting. So voters can basically put in order the candidates they like from number one to number four or five. They can rank their candidates, and the hope is I might not get my first choice. I might get my third, my fourth, my fifth choice, but at least my voice matters at the ballot box. I'm not completely cut out if all the votes go to the other side. So there are ways to change voting systems, including for the Electoral College, for example. There are ways to change how we count the votes that can have an impact, I think, on voters' perception of the electoral system as something worth participating in. So Electoral Colleges, most states send all of their electors, say they have 10 electors. If Joe Biden were to get 51% of the vote, all 10 electors go to Joe Biden. Another alternative would be he would get six electors, because that would be roughly proportional to his percentage of the vote, and Donald Trump would get 4 of the electors, the 40% that were roughly consistent with his proportion of the popular vote. So those are ways of tweaking how we actually count the ballots and how much they count that would, if given a sufficient education and understanding, maybe have more buy-in from the American public. But I think in speaking to young people in particular, I do it on college campuses, I'm a law professor, there really is, I think, a lack of perception of how important voting is. I think there's a sense that, well, my vote doesn't really matter, and the way to change the system is something more dramatic. So we've seen a lot of participation in protests, for example. But having written last year's book that I wrote on the Constitution, Constitutional Basics, I'm more convinced than ever that pretty much everything that we care about in politics or policy, whether LGBTQ rights, the climate change, immigration, healthcare, all of it really has to happen at the ballot box. And so if we don't participate, we're not doing the most important thing we can to shape our own election and our own lives. That's number one. The second piece, what I tell young people, is to keep in mind what a privilege it is to live in a democracy where elections are actually functioning in a meaningful way. That's not the case across the globe. A lot of people live in countries where their vote really doesn't matter. They really are beholden to people in power. And so I think just like we are as a country facing protests and taking pains to recognize privileges of certain groups over privileges of other groups, I think voting is a way to recognize the privilege of being American over other parts of the world where people just don't have this precious ability to choose our own leaders.
We almost take for granted, if you will, free and fair elections. Like, we just assume it will always be there.
Yes, we assume the free and fair elections will always be there, just like we assume we'll have a government by we the people and we'll have people in office that color in the lines. And, you know, people say, oh, well, all this will blow over. The answer is no. The answer is that elections, or that, excuse me, democracies fail. We saw it with Turkey in our own lifetime. The last really sort of robust democracy on the globe was Athenian Greece 2,000 years ago. It took 2,000 years for the American experiment to come onto the planet. And democracy in this moment is hanging by a thread in the United States. I am completely convinced. John Bolton himself said this in connection with his promoting his book with respect to this president, that if this president, this kind of government continues for four more years, we can see the end of democracy itself in America. And that's worth saving. That's even if it's not your favorite candidate on the ballot on your side of the aisle, it's worth voting just to save the system, just to save the process. That is really, really precious. And if that were to fail, it's kind of too late to then put that back on the ballot. Now is the time. So if you have to hold your nose and your favorite person is not on there, vote for someone that's going to function a color within the lines, respect the norms, respect the laws, so that we can get back on track as a government by we the people that respects the rule of law and norms. That alone is worth going to the polls for, and then wait for your favorite candidate maybe down the line when we have a government that actually is legitimate again in the eyes of the world.
If you're just joining us, we have Kim Whaley with us, a law professor at the University of Baltimore, a constitutional expert. You can join in. What questions do you have about voter suppression or voter fraud? Are you concerned about voter misinformation? How do you see this playing out online or in your community on social media? What questions do you have about voter processes in our country? 800-642-1234 to join in. Let's bring in Eileen, who is joining us from Whitewater this morning. Hi, Eileen.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for your wonderful show. I'd like to ask the professor if she thinks it's lawful that mail-in ballots have to be witnessed, especially under COVID, and I live alone. I'm just wondering if that requirement is necessary.
Eileen, that's a really good question. And whether it's necessary is a different question from whether it's lawful. I happen to believe that, or take the point of view, that when it comes to balancing these things, let me back up a little bit how the courts look at this. The courts look at this as a balancing test. They'll say on the one hand, listen, we have the state that has real interest in making sure elections are free of fraud and that they function efficiently. That's on one hand. On the other side of the scale, we've got the individual voter like Eileen, who has a constitutional right to vote and should be able to do that without a lot of burden on her day or what she needs to do, rearrange her work, get somebody to drive her to the place, find someone who is COVID-free to witness it, for example. So the courts will balance those two things. I happen to believe that Eileen's right to vote and the burdens on her should weigh much more heavily than the interests of the state in preventing fraud in light of the fact right now that the evidence of fraud is so minuscule. So in my mind, there should be strong evidence from the government that, listen, we need this second ballot, this second signature, because here's all of the evidence, all the examples of fraud through signatures. That's not how the courts have looked at it. The Supreme Court sometimes has said the interest of the voter outweighs the limitation, but sometimes the courts have said, listen, that makes sense to me. I'm not gonna strike that down. So we're seeing across the country different changes to voting under COVID. Some are very broad. We have five states where it's easy to vote by mail, even before COVID. Not a lot of fraud in those states. That's why I'm skeptical of the fraud argument.
So why is it such a central argument? Why do we put up so many of these rules in order to prevent the fraud that is out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's running an undercurrent through our voting system is this belief that only the right people should be able to exercise their right to vote. And I say that because at the time the Constitution was ratified, only white male landowners could vote. That was expanded to African Americans that were formerly males that were enslaved, eventually to women, eventually to people under the age of 20, between 18 and 21. But there still is this belief in our opt-out in system. That is, we have to prove that we're eligible to vote. There still is this belief that we've got to keep this access to the polls tight. We've got to hold on and make the door not so wide open. I just don't think that is consistent with government by we the people, because what that ends up doing is empowering politicians to pick and choose who has access to the polls.
We're learning how votes are cast and counted in America and the threats to our electoral process. University of Baltimore Law Professor Kim Whaley is our guide for the hour. Have you had trouble registering to vote before or keeping track of your registration if you've moved? Have you ever experienced issues at the polls due to your identification or registration? What advice do you have about how to handle these situations in future elections? Join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up on Voting in America with Kim Whaley right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're spending the hour on American elections, voting procedures, with CBS News legal analyst and law professor Kim Whaley as our guide. Her new book is called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. And she points out that there are about 250 million voting age people in our country, and it's widespread voter apathy, as she's been saying, that is the single biggest factor plaguing our electoral system. What has caused you not to vote in the past? What do you know about how rules are made around voting? Join in 800-642-1234, and Kim Whaley stays with us. Let's take another call now. Rick is joining us from Elroy. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind about the voting system?
I'm wondering if, like in Europe, they have a lot of countries have four or five parties, you know, and then there's compromise after one party gets in. I'm wondering if the two-party system in America is a broken system, because they basically will agree on nothing. And our beliefs as Americans sometimes have some issues in both parties, and it just doesn't seem to be working.
Kim, what do you think about our system, our two-party system?
You know, I agree. I think the two-party system is one of the biggest problems in our political landscape across the country right now. There's nothing in the Constitution about having only two parties. And it does keep third-party voices off ballots, because there are such long shots that people feel that that's not a worthwhile vote to go in that direction. But even in a two-party system, I think part of the problem is this belief that really started in the 90s, I think, with the Republican sort of revolution under Newt Gingrich, the belief that, you know, compromise is somehow going to hurt people, a party's ability to stay in power. And so we saw with that non-compromising Congress, the Republicans got back in the House, reasserted authority. And we've seen since then this belief that staking your grounds at the polls at the very ends of the spectrum is the way to show strength. And I've been surprised, even with my students, law students, how that generation seems to think compromise is for losers, and that they have this belief in this polarized society, in this polarized political landscape, that it's the tough person that just, you know, stakes their belief and hangs on to it. That's how you get ahead. And unfortunately, that's not how our system works. That's not how it was set up. It was set up for compromise. So I encourage people on both sides of the political spectrum to identify politicians and candidates who are moderate, who are willing to make deals, who are willing to sort of leave certain things off the table in order to move the country forward. I think that mindset is absolutely crucial. And there are hopefully candidates on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, who are still basically moderate and willing to work with each other. The problem is right now a lot of politics is populated with extremists on each end of the spectrum, and that does make us stuck. We are not seeing substantive legislation coming out of this Congress, which is partly why a lot of stuff is being done by agencies and by the presidency, and that's upsetting to people, and it should be, because Congress just isn't doing it.
Well, Rick, thank you for your call. Let's bring in now Rich, who is in Appleton. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how are you? Good morning, Professor Whaley, and good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Good morning, Rich.
I'm in my late 60s, and I hearken back to a time that I was in high school and couldn't vote because I believe it was the 25th Amendment that gave people the right to vote who were between 18 and 21 at the time. I think it was the 25th. I'm not sure, but I know that at the time, people my age were certainly subject to the draft, and that was one of the big things that was concerning at the time, because, you know, we could be drafted into the army, but we couldn't. We had no right to vote. So I definitely agree that it's extremely important that people exercise their right in every election. And regardless of party or affiliation, and I do agree with the professor about the fact that, you know, we currently see this radicalization of the parties. And I don't know how to solve that.
Rich, thank you for bringing that historical perspective. Kim, what are your thoughts there, and especially on the draft and Rich's coming to voting?
Yeah, so right. That was the 26th Amendment, and it's great to have a caller that remembers that. I mean, the idea being, well, listen, it's unfair to send people at the direction of their government to go overseas and die in a war when they can't make decisions about who their government is in the first place. And I think that sentiment is what should, I believe, fuel more access to the polls, fuel fewer restrictions. The same idea that that if just because you are on a college campus, for example, and your ID doesn't look like a DMV ID, but you validly got your ID from the provost on your college campus, that should be enough to be able to vote. And we see what people call voter suppression. We see states adding these cute requirements under the guise of actually addressing voter fraud, but they really function to keep people from the polls. And I think that is very corrosive. As far as what to do about, the concern that people just aren't participating and aren't appreciating it, I really think it comes down to education. Two things: education about how the system actually works in terms of why your vote does matter. It's not just for president. It's not just for in a blue or red state, but it goes all the way down ballot. In some states you vote for judges. In some states you vote for sheriffs, the actual police department. We're seeing frustration with police. And on a macro level, this is how we make sure that no one person gets so much power they can start bullying others arbitrarily. If that starts happening, that's bad for everyone. Even if it's not you being the one bullied, it could be you who's bullied next. The second thing I think is really important is to model this for young people. There are certain things we model in the household, in the home, that you just do. Some people model going to church every Sunday. Some people model having dinner as a family every day, brushing your teeth in the morning, paying your taxes. Voting should be something that is that basic. And I think that kind of education commitment, we cannot always rely on government to do that. It has to be in the individual home. And now is the time, I think, more than at least in my lifetime, to send the alarm, set ring the bell that this election's absolutely vital. Regardless of who you vote for, show up and vote. Tell politicians that we the people are still in charge.
Kim Whaley is with us. Her new book is What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Kim, two things I want to circle back to. You mentioned briefly earlier voter roll purges and absentee voting. The Wisconsin State Supreme Court is going to be deciding on whether 129,000 voters will be removed from the polls. And then voting absentee has gone just through the roof during the pandemic. What are you anticipating there? The effect on the voter roll disputes and absentee voting, what will that have on the November election?
Well, in a case like the 129,000 votes, I mean, if that those votes were to be purged from the rolls, of course, that could have a massive impact on the outcome of the election. You know, George Bush won the presidency by 527 votes in a single state of Florida. So votes do matter. Stacey Abrams lost the governorship by approximately 50,000 votes in Georgia. Those were about the number of votes that then Secretary of State Brian Kemp put on hold due to irregularities or questions regarding signatures or names, for example. So these kind of registration purges, manipulating the rolls do make an have an impact. Federal law does require states to take, quote, reasonable efforts to update their voter rolls. So there is an obligation on the states. We've seen some lawsuits where, you know, primarily conservative lean people on the more Republican side of things will sue states saying, listen, you need to be more aggressive. That is not consistent with what federal law is. Federal law says reasonable. Federal law says you can't throw people off the polls just because they didn't vote. But what you can do is let them know you're considering taking them off the polls, send them a postcard, send them a notice. If they don't then come back and say, hey, I do want to vote, then you can purge. So this is a message again, like I said, the top of the hour, you have to be vigilant, stick it in your calendar, put it in your phone, just like you need to remember to get your cancer screen every year, or you have to get your flu shot, put it in there to just double check that your registration is still working for the next election. Now, with respect to absentee ballots, we are going to see massive, massive upticks in absentee ballot voting across the country for sure. The issue there in this moment is the states need to prepare. They need to plan. They have to order these ballots. They have to use third party special paper. This is not something you go to Kinko's and just Xerox a bunch of stuff. So the states need to know that people are planning to vote by mail. This is not an election where we can wait until a couple weeks before and decide to participate then. Now is the time. And what I'm asking people is not just to ask for your absentee ballot and make sure you're registered, but find one or two friends of yours who usually don't vote and help them over that finish line as well. Mm-hmm. Because if everyone who typically votes brought one person, we would see the numbers that we need to see in order to, again, tell the world that we're a serious democracy.
Only about half, you said, of eligible voters actually vote?
Correct. And it tends to be higher in election years. Presidential election mm-hmm. years. But let me, you know, back on absentee ballots, in states that allow people to vote from home, by mail, those numbers go up. So, and people really like it. Participation by Republicans and participation by Democrats, if they can vote by mail, goes up. I mean, it makes logical sense. You don't have to take the time off from work or get up early or wait in line or figure out your polling place.
Or perhaps be exposed in line to COVID-19.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're looking at the right to vote in America, the perils of our system. Law Professor Kim Whaley, our guide, her new book is called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Do you feel like your vote matters? What could change your mind? What election policies do you think should be implemented? There's still time to talk. We'll be back with Kim Whaley. Stay with us. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. University of Baltimore Law Professor Kim Whaley says it's absolutely vital to support and promote basic civic education in America, especially around voting. Her new book is called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why, and she stays with us. More calls here. Let's bring in Jim in Newport Township. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. And I would like to, you know, everything I've heard is well and good, but I would like to make the general comment that having a good election and providing the public with a selection are oftentimes two different things, and I think so in the case of our body politic, because I don't see an improvement with the quality of office holders in this country until we adopt a runoff election system, because what we have now reinforces this what Ralph Nader calls a duopoly, or and
Well, Jim, I want to jump in here and allow Kim to explain to us what our a runoff election system looks like.
A runoff election system is one, obviously, in which you've got close candidates that that there has to be a separate election to make a determination as to who is going to be in that particular seat. But the second election would determine the top two. As I indicated earlier, one alternative to that, which a lot of people are talking about, is ranked choice voting, how we count the candidates, so that instead of having runoff elections, each voter would go into the ballot box and choose not just candidate red or candidate blue, but I like these are my top five. My number one choice would be candidate blue, maybe number two choice would be candidate red. And then essentially, you count the votes, the lowest vote getter gets off the list, and then your third choice candidate becomes the second choice candidate. So there are other ways that that we can make sure that everyone's vote, even those on the losing side, end up being taken into the calculus at the end.
Kim, do recounts and the request for recounts, does that differ from state to state?
Yes, that will differ. It differs under state law, how that process works, and frankly, who's in charge of making those determinations. Some electoral officials in states are elected, some are appointed, some have moved to more neutral commissions. That is something that really depends on where you live. Again, the right to vote in America hinges on your zip code. That's not the case with a lot of other constitutional rights, but that's the system that we have.
Let's bring in Dave in Grand Chute. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. I had a question about the Electoral College, something I read or heard the other day, that in the case of a tie, it goes to the House of Representatives, but it's not a one-on-one vote. It's a delegation that votes. And I'm wondering what that means exactly.
Kim, what does that mean? Yeah.
You know, that is something that's a really great sort of specific question that, to be in all honesty, I would have to do a little bit of research to answer it accurately. Of course, we are in a position where hopefully we're not going to have a close election that is so close that we're going to have to punt it to the Congress to resolve that. But that's I can get an answer to that and tweet it. But unfortunately, Kate, I don't have it right now.
Well, untangle for us the difference between the Electoral College and the popular vote. With, you know, we've had where, you know, the election has been won with not the popular vote.
Yeah. So as I indicated earlier, you know, when you go to the polls and you vote for president, you're actually not voting for the person on the presidential ticket. You're voting for electors that are chosen by various ways in your state under your state's law. And then those electors will go and vote for president. And there's a case right now pending before the United States Supreme Court as to whether those electors can basically do what they want and ignore the popular vote. Or whether they're bound by the popular vote. In most states, they are bound to vote according to what the populace tells them to. That being said, each state has a certain number of electors that's determined by census numbers. The electors in most states are winner takes all. So if a state gets 51% of the votes in a state go to Donald Trump, for example, Donald Trump will get all 10 or 100% of the electors. So the problem there, people don't like it, is that, okay, the 40% then that voted for Joe Biden or someone else, once you actually are voting for president, their votes are canceled out because the winner-take-all system means all 100% of the electors go to whoever gets 51% or more of the vote. So that is, I think, how we get to a situation where the popular vote doesn't match up with the Electoral College because of the systems on a state-by-state basis that require electors vote winner takes all, not proportionally. If states were to individually decide, listen, my state, I want to have people that cast their ballots proportionally so that even those that voted for the less popular candidate would still be counted in the Electoral College, we might see less of a disconnect between the popular vote and the Electoral College because it would all line up by state proportionally. I think that's where we're left off. But I should say, with large numbers, if we had more people voting, if it weren't 50% of the eligible population, but much higher than that, then we might not get in a situation where the margins are so slim we see this disconnect. It tends to happen historically when it's not a landslide, where it's not a real strong vote for one candidate over the other. When the votes are really slim, like we saw Bush versus Gore, 537 votes in Florida put Mr. Bush in the White House, Al Gore won the popular vote. It's those moments where we get this disconnect. If we can get more participation and more people engaging in democracy, perhaps we won't see these slim, slim margins.
Well, let's land on threats here. Deb called from Plymouth, couldn't stay with us and wanted to circle back to voter fraud and concerns there. Deb mentioned the ALES, American Legislative Exchange Council, and wanted to know more about this council and what it is doing.
The AIDS... say that again?
The American Legislative Exchange Council.
I don't have that on my fingertips either. Maybe she has a little more information on it.
Yeah, okay. And you know, we haven't talked about misinformation and the impact of social media here as people prepare to vote. What do you see going on in that realm?
As people prepare to vote?
And the influence of social media and as well as misinformation.
Yeah, so misinformation, as we know from the 2016 presidential election, is really serious. I think we know from the Mueller report and from, you know, Senate committee bipartisan investigations that the Russians tried to infiltrate our elections. It's still happening. A lot of people think, well, they didn't actually attack specific elected systems and change votes. But the way they affect it is to spread lies on the internet into people's phones that keep people home from the polls, make them feel cynical about voting, make them mad at other Americans based on false information, make them cast votes in ways that are inaccurate. So it is really important, I think, in the rise of social media, even more important for Americans to not only educate themselves about voting, but go to sources, various sources that have integrity to get facts about information. Go to news outlets that self-police for accuracy as a matter of how their systems run internally, not because they'll go to jail if there's something false on there, but because they care a lot. And I should just say the experts do believe Facebook is not a great place to get news in general. That particular platform is not as accurate as other places. It's better to go to original news sites. I would also, frankly, like to see... the social media being used to spread the word about voting rather than doing it at DMVs, rather than do it at, you know, physical get out the vote rallies. I think we all should use this new medium to spread the importance of voting and how to do it. And actually, I do know, I think your caller is talking about Alec, and I can answer that actually if we still have time.
Oh, Kim, we are out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Kate. It's always the hour just flies by, and I want to thank your listeners for the great questions, for paying attention and for paying attention to this really, really important question of American democracy.
Kim Whaley, law professor at the University of Baltimore. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.